You.
Good evening. Oh, pardon me.
Oh,
you go.
Hi. Oh, me? Okay. Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. Here with the hard-hitting talking during the COVID-19 quarantine.
What number are we on now?
I think we're on 17.
Okay.
Episode 17 of the COVID-19 quarantine.
On track.
Yep.
For COVID-19.
It's true. Speaking of quarantine, I watched a film last night called The Aviator.
Who's in that?
Little known actor Leonardo DiCaprio.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. Directed by this obscure director named Martin Scorsese.
Oh. He's an Italian-American man?
True. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty much only known for his obscure documentary on Giorgio Armani. which I haven't seen yet. I was looking up what else is this Martin Scorsese guy made other than the obvious, and I was surprised to see that. But the film, which I can't recommend, it begins with, you know, the scene of the young Howard Hughes being washed in a tub by his mother. And it's a strange, like kind of large circular tub where he's just standing in the middle. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it didn't make sense within the time frame of the movie, but I'm sure it was accurate knowing Mr. Scorsese. But he has typhus or typhoid fever or something like that.
Mm.
And his mom is teaching him how to spell the word quarantine.
Whoa.
And so watching it right now was so bizarre, you know, because it was like Q-U-A. And then throughout the film, this is a refrain, him returning to this, you know, early formative moment where he learned to spell quarantine.
Wow.
I know, right?
It's nuts, isn't it? It's like, well, it's crazy how... Obviously, there have been like reflections. Like, it's a feature of historical figures' lives, you know, like i.e. Howard Hughes, for example, you know, or anyone who was alive in the earlier part of the 20th century.
Sure.
Or anything set, you know, in multiple different time frames, you know, like it's a feature of Shakespearean England, and it's a feature of, you know, the heyday of Venice, and, you know, any the, you know, various Renaissance time periods and such. But I think it's funny that now that those moments have real meaning, you know, like Scorsese's using that to like sort of as like a touchstone for this character. But, you know, I don't think he himself had ever really experienced anything of the kind. You know what I mean? Like it had no...
Oh, Martin? No, probably.
Yeah. Not. Yeah, yeah. No, it's just a sort of narrative abstraction that could be deployed, you know, and then... Or like my reference for this cinematically is always the Dan Brown films.
Are they quarantined in those?
Well, there's like biblical plagues that will be unleashed by like sinister forces inside the Catholic Church.
I see.
Who are themselves enacting, I think this is the second film, Inferno. Inferno's the third film. The second film?
I haven't seen any of them.
Tom Hanks. I can, unlike your lackluster recommendation of The Aviator, I can only recommend specifically Angels and Demons, which is either the second or the third of the Dan Brown adaptation starring Thomas Hanks. I can only recommend them strongly.
COVID
beyond
survivor.
Strongly. COVID survivor. Whoa, full circle. Also the star of my favorite film, Cloud Atlas.
oh, God.
But there's like, you know, sinister groups within the Catholic Church are going to unleash new bioengineered plagues. This is definitely the plot of Inferno. And Tom Hanks, of course, can see that they've been like working on this for like maybe 2,000 years and have been... laying out clues since the Italian Renaissance.
Okay.
And This is how we know to like run across the rooftops of Milan and, you know, jump from the roof onto the gondola to escape the like rampaging sinister assassin that's chasing mild-mannered medievalist Tom Hanks. In the first one, The Da Vinci Code, he has sort of a amazing early aughts mullet. And he has these amazing early aughts suits, the kind of suits that like Fraser wears, but they seem to also actually a similar sort of hair length scenario to Fraser, although like not as straight, you know, curlier. Mm-hmm. It's Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. But it's just the kind of outfit that you kind of forgot Tom Hanks had ever worn. Because in your the image of Tom Hanks is always like today's Tom Hanks or the Polar Express, and so it's hard to see him in this sort of intermediate stage between like Tom Hanks and Big and middle-aged Tom Hanks, where he's like just cresting in. It's a really weird watch. The Da Vinci Code is really nuts, and I think Angels and Demons is the best one. That's the one where the sinister forces within the Vatican steal some antimatter from CERN.
As
a last-ditch bid to do like a false flag operation to suss out the Illuminatus who are hiding inside the Vatican and subverting its message. So it's like a sort of, you know, there's like multiple sort of loops inside that one. Not to be a spoiler, but believe me, you'll forget everything I tell you about these movies within 10 seconds of starting to watch them, because they are literally so dazzling, and so much happens. Can I ask, what was the process by which you arrived at deciding to watch The Aviator?
The process of watching films at our home, at our house, is it's like I try to put together like thematized chunks of movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I get lazy and I just want to work on my computer, which is in the same room as the TV. And on those mm-hmm. nights, you know, it's not from that pile. And Ella usually works on her computer as well while the movie's on. Mm-hmm. It's a very intimate experience. And, she in those moments when she chooses the movie, she prefers to watch something that neither of us really have to engage with.
Fair.
She's the kind of person that likes strategy. Like, she has TV playing in her studio during the day when she's working. I can't really do that, but in the evening, it's nice to have a movie playing. You look up every once in a while and think, oh, wow, that's a cool outfit that Howard Hughes is wearing in 1940 or whatever. But I think it was two nights ago, we watched Catch Me If You Can, which is one of my dad's favorite movies.
That does star Tom Hanks?
That stars Tom Hanks and Leo. And then, you know, Ella wanted to see another Leo movie, and she asked if I'd seen The Aviator, which I hadn't.
Right. And so this was just like a Leonardo DiCaprio movie that wasn't like The Beach or something like that, that like one tends to watch.
No, and I guess it turned out to be thematized as well, because there were Leonardo DiCaprio movies about, you know, air flight.
Yeah, true. Okay.
He doesn't really fly, but he flies on planes illegally.
Yeah.
And then, but of course, I think I stayed away from the Howard Hughes thing, because Howard Hughes, I don't know much about him. I guess I know a little more now, but he's definitely one of those characters that you just knew there was a lot there to uncover.
Yeah.
But exactly how it worked, I had no idea. According to this film, he comes from Houston oil money, which I didn't know. They were like a tool and die dynasty. Mm-hmm. And he moved to Hollywood and started blowing the family fortune on making enormously expensive movies. His first movie was called Hell's Something, Hell's Angels, I think, about a World War II dogfight. And there were like 200 planes involved, 5,000 extras. He was spending like $25,000 a day for 3 years. He made the entire...
And this is like in the 19-teens or something like that, which...
Yeah. Maybe it was a World War I movie then.
Okay.
Because if it was World War II, it'd probably be after the 40s.
Right, okay.
So maybe, yeah, it was a World War I movie, I guess. He made the whole film, and then right about the time he was ready to release it, talkies came out. So he redid the whole thing with sound. But it was amazing because he,
wow.
he according to the film, he was so frustrated that the planes didn't look like they were going fast enough.
Right. Because he has the experience of flying planes.
Yeah. And also, you know, like without a reference background, like if you're shooting from below the plane up or whatever, they don't look like they're
yeah.
like when you see a jet plane up in the sky, you're like, that's going very slow.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. Right.
So then he steals a professor of meteorology from UCLA, puts him on the payroll to try and like make clouds so that they could get those shots to look better. And then also spent tons of money developing faster planes in order to make them look fast. You actually go faster and therefore look faster on camera.
That's insane.
And then that.
So the simulacra sort of precedes the need to like break airspeed records.
Yeah. And then, you know, through developing, he ends up developing one of the fastest planes. And through that starts Hughes Aircraft, which became his real job.
Right.
So it was all in pursuit of making the planes look faster on film that he started, you know, one of the largest aircraft manufacturing companies of the time.
Huh. I get him and Lindbergh confused, even though like Hughes is like the guy who's Citizen Kane, basically. Right.
No, William Randolph Hearst was Citizen Kane.
Jeez Louise, I get them all confused.
So Hearst was a...
But wait, Hearst is the newspaper guy.
Yeah, owned right. many newspapers. Hughes was a like an oil kid who turned ended up owning TWA.
But Hughes is the one who ends up living in the hotel with his curly fingernails and keeping his urine in jars.
Exactly, yeah.
And Hearst just dies alone in his castle, and Lindbergh...
I don't think
Hearst, a Nazi.
I doubt Hearst died alone, but he definitely had a castle.
Right. Well, I think he did. I think he died friendless, not unattended. I think that was the reason why Citizen Kane, why Orson Welles got thrown out of his contract.
Okay.
Because he was working for Hearst, made a movie about Hearst as his debut feature film. It was declared the best movie ever made, and then Hearst buried it and refused to promote it and refused to renew Welles' contract. And that's why Welles was like largely an independent filmmaker at the moment when like studios were all power, you know, at the moment of peak studio, Welles was unemployable basically because right. Hearst was so pissed that he had made a fool of him in Citizen Kane.
I will say that there are a couple things. We did a long stretch of watching movies that were set in LA. And there are so many movies that are set in LA that are not marketed as such, you know?
Yeah.
Where you're just like, oh, that one's, of course that one. But then there are movies like To Live and Die in LA where that's the main character.
It's in there. Yeah.
So all of The Aviator is set in Los Angeles, which is amazing because not only did Hughes make movies, but he also was a big player in aerospace, which it's right. easy to forget that this was one of the leading sites for aerospace technology at that time.
Right. And like the Bendix building and stuff like that. Like that was an aerospace company's headquarters in the Garment, what we now think of as the Garment District.
Right. And also I think, MGM Studios was originally in Culver City. And so then Culver City has an enormous amount of presence, clearly, at least the way it's portrayed in this
right.
movie. Like it's like, you know, Howard Hughes from his home in Culver City. It's like they would never say that anymore. You know, they'd say Elon Musk lives in Los Angeles or whatever. You know?
Right.
No one in national news lives in Culver City.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's true. I mean, it's like the valley is in more movies.
Mm-hmm.
Than Culver City is, even though Culver City is in every movie kind of thing. Like, it's funny about coincidental timing. We watched, we've been watching Murder, She Wrote.
Still.
There are 12 seasons.
Okay.
And there are around 20 episodes per season. But,
so you're saying you're lazy.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
The 12th season just wrapped itself up for us.
Oh, okay.
And
at 12 episodes a day, you could be done in a matter of months.
Yeah, it's true. With enough dedication. So we finished the 12th season, but after it's actually kind of, it's not a wild story. It's a dull story, but Murder, She Wrote was essentially canceled by accident. There had been...
The contract was moved it to a, murdered.
They had like established a scenario where like it was like the queen of its time slot on Sunday. And then they moved it to Thursday and it had to compete with like a bunch of shows that now I don't remember at all, but that were apparently very powerful shows. And then and no one wanted to watch Murder, She Wrote on Thursdays. So they sort of canceled it by reducing its economic power, sort of in a backhanded way. And then the network just pulled the plug. But then because it had... because it had sort of been canceled the wrong way, they made a bunch of TV movies. They made four TV movies afterwards.
Okay.
And so now we've been watching the TV movies.
Oh, my goodness.
And the most recent one we watched is set between two time periods. It's very elaborate. It's like, you know, when you consider the budget of, you know, made for TV movies or whatever, you know, so half of it is set in the antebellum South and half of it is set in the present day. And Jessica Fletcher plays two characters. I mean, Angela Lansbury plays two characters, herself, her present day sort of mystery writer lady, and her distant ancestor in the South. And she affects a Southern accent, which is absolutely appalling. And her friend in the contemporary time frame is played by, what's her name? Her last name's Rashida. She's like the mom on the Cosby Show.
Okay.
And it all involves like the memory of slavery.
Sure.
And like of all the times to watch like an extremely complicated episode of Murder, She Wrote about the sort of legacy of enslavement and how the Confederacy remembers itself, and what those what monuments are for, etc., is like, it's really wild. It's really wild to see like the, you know, 2000, the late 90s, early aughts version of Murder, She Wrote go through these issues, and like Jessica Fletcher is like pro reparations. Just like kind of like how so little has changed in some ways, but then also that like there's no way on earth much of what's in this could ever get made. It was real wild. It was a real trip. But one of those things similar to your thing where the Scorsese movie where like he says quarantine in the first sentence, you know, and you're just like, what? You know, and you weren't watching it because it had quarantine content, you know, and we're not watching Murder, She Wrote because it reflects on, you know, the movement for Black Lives or anything like that, right? Like we're watching it because we've been watching Murder, She Wrote for like 2 years now. So it's like it's a real trip when these things just pop out of the time hole to scare you with this stuff.
Yeah, or how much of it was there without, you know, that slipped by you. Because I think, you know, since the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests of recent few months, we've watched, you know, in watching movies about Los Angeles, I was surprised that just like 90% of them are about police violence.
Right.
Like,
I mean, yeah. Like Training Day and all, like everything. LA Confidential. Everything's basically, just about police violence. Yeah, yeah, it's true.
And I just shamefully had never thought of it that way. You know, like here's a LA Confidential. There are horrible scenes of cops pinning murders that they were guilty of on young Black men. Mm-hmm. It's just like, why was this a plot point that I didn't remember?
You know, it's funny. I mean, like as like a person who, for whom like at least in the first several years of my life, like America was just a very abstract place, you know, like okay. It was the place on TV. Mm-hmm. And it was, and you understood that it was like not that different from Canada, but you also knew that it wasn't Canada, mm-hmm. You know, like, or maybe more importantly for Canadians, Canada is not the United States.
Okay.
in terms of the sort of psychological mind frame. So we you watch the media, you know, like the movie, all the movies on TV are all from America for the most part. But then all the TV shows are from America. But the impression that everyone in, you know, like in the schoolyard would have of Los Angeles was just like a place of uncontrolled police brutality. Because like, you know, when I was a kid, like that's, there were the Rodney King riots and like, you know, like everyone would see the police brutality on the news. You know, like it's like what LA was famous for was just like wanton beatings by cops.
Right.
And I think the funny part is that like, you know, it's like, I mean, not like there's been necessarily much less beating by cops in Los Angeles than ever before, but more that like Los Angeles's police brutality is not the focus of this situation. You know, it's like the Minneapolis police or like, you know, these like federal, unmarked federal cops patrolling Portland or something like that. That these are, this is the sort of like the, it's not, it's like somehow the LAPD managed to like not fuck up in public too badly just in this one supercharged moment. You know, it's like it's the police everywhere else who have decided to like shit the bed on film this last few months, and the LAPD have been like kind of keeping a low profile considering like that they're probably still fully just beating people to death.
Yeah, probably.
But yeah, wild. I remember we put a topic aside when we were talking earlier, and then I've now forgotten what it was. My mind was erased thinking about Howard Hughes.
Oh, he can do that to you. We were talking about squash, your favorite sport.
Oh, my favorite sport. Yeah, yeah. God.
And
R.I.P.
I have been watching
a
television series called The Red Shoe Diaries. Or maybe there's no article, Red Shoe Diaries. I don't want any of the diehard fans to get angry with me.
They all listen to the show.
Yeah. Which is, it was, it's been fun to watch because it was a late night made for Showtime. I know you're recently familiar with Showtime. Cinemax maybe being a better referent. Although this did air on Showtime, like, you know, like the kind of shows that aired after midnight.
They'd be a little sexier.
Definitely be sexier. Yeah, like what we'd call softcore porn, which perhaps is not, I realize, is maybe not even a cultural object anymore.
Yeah, there's just porn.
There's
now,
just
right?
just like gonzo porn is all there really is.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, watching like these like made for like pay-per-view TV subscription softcore late night show.
The saxophones come on.
Saxophones, the, like, hosted by David Duchovny.
Right.
Which is incredible because there was a film made by Zalman King, I think in the 80s, called Red Shoe Diaries that stars Duchovny. His wife cheats on him and he discovers this through reading her diary after she's died. And then he's kind of retracing the affair and confronts the guy, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end of that film, he goes to like, I think what is like probably Nick's Diner south of Chinatown.
Mm. Yeah.
Or in Chinatown. And, which is incredible. It's that definitely that, I think it's that neighborhood. And, inside the diner is a like 20 PO boxes, which I would be incredible to have a PO box at a diner. We can like get a cup of Joe and check your mail.
I mean, that's a business. That's a like a socially distanced business that's just waiting to happen.
Yeah, for sure. But he puts out an ad in the paper, you know, asking if you've been cheated on, blah blah blah. Please write to this PO box. Subject line: Red Shoe Diaries. That's how the film ends. And then I guess it got picked up by Showtime and became like a late night sexy show and went for three seasons.
Each of these are sort of like Penthouse Letters kind of thing, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, basically. And so every episode begins where he walks to the cafe with his dog and then opens the letter, and there's a, you know, cuts, it goes into a voiceover and beautiful shots of the sunset in LA and, you know, Dear David or whatever his character's name is.
Right.
But it's curious because well, like, since it's softcore porn, there has to be like enough of a backdrop. Like, people have to have jobs. There has to be a scenario. There has to be like just enough.
Right.
And that's what fascinates me about it, is like, what is the just enough to be a character? Like, what?
Yeah.
Well, like, in our time, you have to be employed, I guess. It seems to be the theme. One of the tenets. And then also, you know, it's not that racy by today's standards.
Right.
So there's usually just, it's like more about the erotic lead up to the sex scene. But the one that stars Squash is about, this woman has a lot of people from Star Trek in this show, actually.
That's the way TV works in general, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You have an agent and they get you other TV gigs. But she's like she's a beautiful blonde woman. She's in The Next Generation. She's kind of Eastern European sounding to me. She has some technical, or maybe she's security, I think, in TNG.
Tasha Yar?
Yes, exactly. So Tasha Yar is a police officer, and she goes to the same gym, and she works out with like a backwards hat. It's pretty great.
Cool.
And leads you to believe that she has sexual relations with many men at the gym, which is probably just what happens with single people go to the gym. But there's a guy who only comes in and plays squash, who refuses to look at her or will never look at her. And so therefore she becomes infatuated with him.
Right.
And it all just centers around these like sweaty squash games he plays against another man and her like leaning up against the glass and the other guy acknowledging that she's like, just like blatantly staring at them playing squash. But she, you know, this guy, Nick, will not look at her. And so then she breaks his rear view, one of his rear taillights on his car in the parking lot, and then follows him home and pulls him over in her cop car, arrests him, takes him to an art gallery that the week before she said that she had busted for drugs. So it's like a contemporary art space that had been shut down and has caution tape everywhere because they were doing drugs at an opening.
Oh dear.
And then she like locks him inside of some chain link cage sculpture that was left over from the exhibition and just kind of, I don't know, you know, has her way with him.
That rules.
Yeah. It was pretty uncomfortable. It was not, it was one of like, some of the episodes are turn on, some are not. For me, this one was not, you know, it was, like, definitely not the common narrative of police brutality.
That's true. That isn't what you really, although it's funny. There was a lot of, sort of like, funky hard rock from Los Angeles that did feature this exact idea
of a female like, cop, taking advantage of a man.
Features prominently on a Red Hot Chili Peppers song. If I'm
really,
I believe from the breakthrough album, Blood Sugar Sex Magic. And I forget the name of the song, but I have a semi clear memory of this. And then there's also, I believe, an entire band based on this concept called Hot Action Cop.
Hot Action Cop.
Yeah. And I know about this band only because I worked in a used CD store, and it was around the corner from the three major sort of broadcast news outlets in Toronto, and I think people from the media would come by and try and get rid of stuff that they had, you know, that had just clogged up their inbox at work, so to speak, you know, and they would bring by all the promos, and it was cool because on the one hand we would often like end up selling like a used CD before a record even came out, and sometimes there would be buzz about a release, you know, and people would be excited about that. But generally speaking, it was just like, you know, whatever horrible shit, some entertainment megacorp was trying to shove down the people's throat that week. You know, someone would try and sell it to us, and we would be like, sorry, only the finest independent rock music is had here, sir.
We need
only like minimal techno from Germany, and
or it needs one more kink to be worthy of our shelves.
Like, yeah, or it just has to sell, frankly, which is the other thing. I don't think Hot Action Cop really... like, you've never heard of them, have you?
I'm going to look it up as soon as we get out of here.
The album cover is a very... it's like the, it's like that Ween album cover, but not a joke.
Yeah, well, I can highly recommend Red Shoe Diaries.
All right, well... If we're looking for something a little spicier than Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah, I mean, it might be worth getting the blood flowing after that, all that literary murder work.
Yeah, what? Why are the shoes red?
Oh, well, in the film version, the cinematic masterpiece, Red Shoe Diaries, the female lead goes to get her eyes checked. Duchovny, she's a dancer but also works as an interior decorator. That's how she makes her money. And Duchovny fancies himself a sculptor of the LA skyline, and he's an architect who's rebuilding downtown, and he has built
it never changes, it's still happening.
Yeah, they live in a former glue factory in downtown, which I'm sure in like 91 or whatever seemed really risky, but now is just like where Hauser and Wirth is or whatever.
Yeah.
And they live there, and he's built a scale maquette of the downtown skyline of LA, and he has like a large cinema light that he shines at it to simulate the sun so he can like do his sculpting. And she goes to her optometrist, which is downtown as well, and her eyes are kind of blurry, and she like falls, and this like hunky construction guy saves her, who happens to be shirtless, and she kind of, you know, they kind of lock eyes or whatever, and then she ends up following him home from work a few days later. She goes and finds him out at the same construction site and follows him home. And turns out he works during the day as a construction guy, and at night he works at a women's shoe store and sells sexy shoes. And she comes in to buy a pair of shoes, and he puts her in a pair of red pumps. So this object of the red shoes becomes a fascination of their affair, and then later of Duchovny's uncovering of the affair through the diary. There's like a heated scene towards the end because Duchovny befriends this guy, because the guy doesn't know, he never met Duchovny. Mm-hmm. He befriends him, and then Duchovny challenges him to a game of basketball when they're at a bar drinking together. And Duchovny has a basketball court in his loft that he's made himself. And turns out, you know, architect by day, but really good street baller by night.
Right.
And he like takes this guy to task and then throws the red shoes at him. And, you know, the red shoes become the proof that he knows and that he was in fact the...
Stupfing his wife.
Yeah, and the wife's passed away. And of course, they're both sad.
How did she die?
I think she killed herself. Jeez, I don't remember.
Oh,
yeah,
geez.
She kills herself. Yeah, she's conflicted about her affair.
Oh no, that sucks. You don't need to do that, lady.
Yeah, but I'm second guessing myself. Don't quote me on how she dies in the film. I forget.
It's cancer.
I feel like it's a bathtub slit the wrist kind of thing. But
oh no, oh yeah. God, I feel like. You know, in script writing, it's just so easy to give people cancer. Write end cancer.
Or car crash.
Yeah, and then you just get rid of the character. The character's, the actor's free, their contract's over, it's fine. You know, you're out of the show.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does seem to be getting late. It's going on for, what is it now, 12:30?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it's time we wrap things up.
Sounds good. It's pretty late. Put on an episode of Red Shoe Diaries. Get out a bottle of red wine.
It's the time.
Yeah, it's that hour. It's now streaming on. Whatever.
It's amazing to think about like both in terms of like Showtime erotic TV series and like the fatal move of moving Murder, She Wrote from like Sunday to Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
When like I have literally watched an episode of Murder, She Wrote every day of the week for the last year and a half. It doesn't matter to me what day. Murder, She Wrote's on, you know, but like this idea or this true fact that like for a time, what time a television show was on was just super important. And that like Thursday night was big TV time and you could not mess with that, you know, with your stable but respectable showing of Murder, She Wrote owning Sunday night after, you know, before the news on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Just like really wild to think about, you know, like, cause like right now, as we speak, I'm sure like, you know, someone within like a block radius of me is just like slamming some like gnar porn right now. You know, it's not like there's only like after 12:30, then you can have the racy stuff.
Yeah. No, that mechanism has become really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Part of the reason I've been watching all this late night garbage.
Yeah, but you've been watching it so that you can watch it during the daytime and transgress the rules, or
I can watch it whenever I want. I mean, I definitely would like at the time, like either because of like my dad making more money or something. Like at the time where like we'd go to a hotel and my parents would get a room, we get the room next to it. My brother and I would definitely put this stuff on, you know, like try and stay up to be like, okay, like I'm 13 years old. I want to see some Skinamax.
Yeah. 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 That thrill, which is now just like, obviously children are growing up without that.
Yeah. They look on their phones or whatever.
Yeah.
We'll never understand the intricacies of my sexuality. Yeah, it was a
tough
suicide.
Man.
Sorry, I was nervous about getting that wrong. She kills herself. I can't remember how, but
trigger warning.
Confirmed, yeah.
All right. Well, good night, Chinatown.
Good morning, Chinatown.